This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Dawn Blagrove found her mission in life as a young girl after she read The Spook Who Sat by the Door. The novel follows Dan Freeman, a black CIA agent, as he takes his knowledge of how the system works back to his community in Chicago to help start a revolution. So Dawn decided to study political science and then became a lawyer. And today she's executive director of Emancipate NC. She uses the knowledge she got from 3 degrees to help communities in North Carolina recognize the power they have to affect change. Dawn Blagrove joins me now to talk more about her childhood in Milwaukee in the 70s and 80s and how it made its mark on her work and who she is today. Dawn, welcome back.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Talk about this novel. Tell me more about The Spook Who Sat by the Door and its influence on you.
So The Spook Who Sat by the Door is, like you said in your introduction, it was transformative for me in my life. It merged together my middle-class college-educated background and upbringing and trajectory with a very pan-African Black nationalist spirit and orientation in the world. So it made me understand and appreciate that in order to create the change that I wanted to see in the world and the change that was necessary for my people to thrive in America, we had to, at least some of us, had to be able to successfully infiltrate the system, understand it, learn it, and then demolish it from the inside.
Well, as we say, that book was, or the novel was about a man who's going to help start a revolution because he learns how the American apparatus really works, starts a revolution within a Chicago neighborhood. Was that your sense of kind of where you were headed? And did that seem dangerous to you at the time, or just like, oh, that's what I need to do when I grow up? I could be a doctor and help people.
I can't ever think of a time when it felt dangerous. I understood the danger associated with it, but I also understood that in juxtaposition to the harm that the current systems in America have on Black people, that the choice between those two evils was easy. It was easy to dedicate. It was easier to dedicate my life to fighting against the system, fighting against systemic and institutional racism, fighting against oppression, than it was to imagine a life where I left a world and lived a life for my children and grandchildren that came as the one that I came into.
Now talk about how that system looked to you as you were growing up in Milwaukee in the late 70s and early 80s.
To me, the system looked rotten. It looked rotten from its core. It looked and still is inherently racist because it has, there's no way to exculpate America from the racist DNA in America's underpinning. And I understood that very, very early age. And that was always something that oriented. So growing up in Milwaukee, which is one of the most segregated cities in the country, has across the board the worst, satisfaction of life statistics, right, for Black people in all of the country. Milwaukee is always at the very top of the worst list for Black folks, worst for Black children, you know, Black men. I grew up in the zip code 53216, where somewhere in the neighborhood of 50%. Or more of all Black men will at some point be incarcerated, where there is somewhere in the neighborhood of a 60% unemployment rate for Black men. I grew up in an area in Milwaukee and Wisconsin that was so severely segregated, and it was so very clear that there was a space and a place for Black people to stay and to exist and to be marginalized, and that you were not to leave that. There was a 40-block radius that was redlined, very, very, you know, in the 30s or 40s for Black folks. And all Black people lived within this 30-block radius, and still do for the most part in Milwaukee.
And it was in that neighborhood that your parents decided that you were going to learn about the Black nationalist ideals, understand the history that was not going to be in your history books, and instill in you a sense of pride. What was your neighborhood like, and what was that family like? How did they get to that place where they were going to resist so openly in a place where segregation, as you say, it was designed to tell people this is where you stay?
So my parents were, are both actually, unbeknownst to them at the time that they met, both from a very small town in Macomb, Mississippi. My family ended up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin through the Great Black Migration from the South. My parents were deeply, deeply rooted, not just because of that moment in time in history for Black Americans where we were finding a sense of pride in ourselves. My family had always had that sense of pride. My mother's father, Larry Jenkins, had served in the military, but he spoke to us all the time about how he did not want to serve in the military, how he was treated worse than Nazi Germans, even by his own fellow white American soldiers because they were white and he was not. How he talked about how he came home from the war and was treated with such disdain and disrespect. But my family always had a strong fighting spirit. My grandfather was the first Black man to buy a house on the block that my mother grew up on. My grandfather was one of the first Black men in Milwaukee to have a taxi token to be able to drive taxi cabs. He was just a fighter, and that was what he taught us. He always said to us to know who our enemy was, to know that it wasn't in our heads, that it wasn't our imagination, that there were systems, institutions, and people who were trying to restrain us. But at the same time, that the reason they were trying to restrain us is because they never wanted us to really understand our greatness. And so that is the spirit that was infused into my mother. That was the spirit that was infused into my parents. And that was just the natural spirit that they infused into us.
And your mother would go to bat for you and make sure that, especially in school, when you would lose points for maybe being outspoken when the teacher wasn't expecting it, right?
Right, which was always. I'll tell you, let's see. So there's so many times. Yeah, my mother and a group of other Black mothers who followed us around through one school to the other from middle school or from elementary school through high school. Because in Milwaukee, there was a very early on, like in the early 80s when I started, there was this new program called the Gifted and Talented Program. So in Milwaukee, all of the gifted and talented children went to one school. We all went to one elementary school, then we went to another middle school, and then we went to one of two high schools. So from third grade on, my mother found her tribe of other mothers who would not ever settle for second-class status for their children in any respect. And those mothers and those women found each other, and they demanded the absolute best for us at every turn. And not only did they demand the best for us, they went to bat for us to be able to stand in our Blackness and for that to be, and for our Black culture and history to be something that we were allowed to elevate in the classroom in whatever way we wanted.
Well, give us an example, because I know you had a modest proposal that was docked a couple of points, and your mother said, oh no.
That was in high school.
Oh, that was high school. All right.
We were studying about the Irish famine, and we had to write our own modest proposal. So the modest proposal that I drafted was one about, and for those who don't know what the modest proposal is, it is something that is, it was like a
Well, John,
like
Jonathan's,
exercising,
yeah, Jonathan Swift,
in kind of sarcasm or whatever,
right,
to help drive home a point. Anyway, so I decided that my modest proposal would be about white people becoming slaves for Black people, and that was the only way that we could undo the racial inequity in America. And that's what my modest proposal was about. And the teacher that I had was horribly offended by it, and would not allow me to read it in class. It was just really, like, it just really set her off, and she gave me a terrible grade. And my mother, anticipating that that would be the reaction, was ready and willing and quickly swept in to correct her, to tell her that just because my modest proposal made her feel uncomfortable, it was reflective of the change that I wanted to see in the world. And because of that, I had a right to say it, and she would not use her white fragility to superimpose on me a sense that I should make myself or my thoughts smaller. That's just who my mother was.
Well, let me,
who my mother is.
We're up against a break here, but I do want to ask you this, because then it was unsettled in your home as you grew a little bit older and into your early teens. Your father became addicted to crack. What impact did that have?
That started somewhere around middle school, and the effect that it had was very little on my sense of stability, because my mother just really and truly stood up in that space that so many do all over America, and filled the gap, and was incredibly intentional and deliberate about making sure that my brother and I did not feel or experience any real detriment to having one parent that had an addiction problem. And she just stepped in and filled that space in a way that was absolutely remarkable and stunning.
I'm talking to Dawn Blagrove, who is my guest today and executive director of Emancipate NC, a nonprofit dedicated to dismantling structural racism and mass incarceration. We'll continue that conversation on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Dawn Blagrove grew up in segregated Milwaukee in the 70s and 80s in an African nationalist household. Her parents had ties to the Black Panther Party, and her mom worked hard to create a home that instilled Black pride in her children. Today, Dawn is executive director of Emancipate NC. So we talked about the fact that you were well aware, Dawn, of of what was going on in your neighborhood from a very early age, that segregation was not a good thing, it was not normal, and that you had a strong feeling you should do something about it. When you get to high school, though, you realize that not everyone grew up the same way and had the same feelings about this system. That's interesting. When did you notice that not everybody recognized what was wrong?
Yeah, it was kind of jarring. I think the first time I recognized it was in middle school. I had a teacher who stood up in front of our class and made a really derogatory statement about Black people, and no one else said anything. And I waited for everyone else to hear everyone else to be outraged, and nobody was. And then I just exploded. So it was around that time that I started getting the clue that people didn't get it the same way that I got it. But I got to high school. I went to Riverside University High School, that was set up kind of like a university, obviously. So we had majors, and my major was open ed, which was similar to liberal arts. And when we would start talking about social issues, it became apparent to me that people had no idea about the people who I idolized. They had no idea what the Black Panther Party was. They had no idea who Huey Newton or Bobby Seale or Angela Davis or H. Rap Brown or even Malcolm X, for that matter. Just no sense of who these people were. And because they had played such incredible roles in crafting who I was as a person and the ideology that I lived by and aspired to, it was absolutely shocking to me that there were other folks that didn't know who those people were, because those folks had always been a part of my life.
Did you then sort of set about teaching people and talking to your teachers, or, you know, sort of raising your hand and say, but what about Huey Newton, or how did that go?
Not only did I set about doing it, I did it with a fervent and a vengeance that I sometimes find embarrassing at this point in my life. I was constantly, you know, many of my friends now from high school who I've reconnected with on Facebook and see the work that I do will comment immediately and say, well, I didn't expect you to be doing anything else. This is exactly who you've always been. I just felt it was so important to help people see the hypocrisy of American life and the schizophrenia of the American ideal system that we were being taught. So I was constantly pushing back in all of my classes with all of my teachers against this whitewashed idea of what America was and interjecting what I knew about the realities of American life for Black and brown people.
Even when it was coming from supposedly, or at least I think perhaps in their own minds, kind of liberal thinking people. I mean, talk about the confrontation you had. Was it a history teacher in high school? It was history, wasn't it?
Yes. Who, to be fair, his name was Mr. Cooney. He was a wonderful man, actually came to my wedding. We became very good friends later on, but he and I were going back and forth, and I can't even remember what the conversation started because it really didn't matter at that point. I was like one of those folks who had new religion, every topic revolved itself back around Black oppression. Like oppression and the oppressed and the oppressors were my favorite words in high school. So we were having a conversation about something, and I called him racist. Oh, no, first, I quoted Huey Newton, my favorite Huey Newton quote, which was, to die for the masses is lighter than a feather, but to die for the people is heavier than a mountain and deeper than any sea. And he stopped and kind of cocked his head and said, did you just quote Huey Newton at me? And I said, yes. And then then I called him racist. And he told me, he was a very private man, but he told me at that moment, that he was not racist because he was married to a black woman. He had a Black woman and Black children. And I told him almost instantaneously that all that did was illustrate how deeply rooted his racism was, and that his racism was so deeply rooted, so deeply seated, that he felt the need to overcompensate by marrying a Black woman to hide his deep racism.
Wow.
And then he still kept talking to me after that. Told me later I was one of his favorite students. I don't know why.
I think I do. If he cared about the truth, sometimes you got to stand there and take it. But talk. So let's take a snapshot of that moment, because I think you did recognize that maybe in some ways that your youthful zeal and energy perhaps was over the top in that moment. But talk about the need. Mm-hmm. Well, let's and if you can correct me. So correct me. Go ahead. But here's kind of my question.
In that moment, I did not think it was over the top at
right,
all.
Right.
I thought I was dead on.
In hindsight, yes. Okay, but that's what I want to get at. So obviously, in the moment, you thought you were absolutely right, and this is a person who needs to be educated, and they need to get it. But talk about the importance of having that kind of energy, of being able to sort of have, because I think sometimes movements get criticized for, you know, making this kind of mistake. Well, they shouldn't have said that. Well, I was okay with them until they broke a window, you know? Hold it a minute. Do you understand the depth of what we're talking about here? There's going to be a broken window. There's going to be some misplaced anger that later we may have to retract. But talk about the importance of having that, to bring that forward so the movement can actually happen.
I think that there is no movement without that. I think that if we are not allowed as Black people, as oppressed people, to stand in the anger and the rage that is caused by dehumanization, by marginalization, then we never get to really get to be heard. And so I think it's really, really important to make people uncomfortable. Part of why America is where it is right now is because too many folks, Black folks, who were doing what they thought was right to advance the movement, but did it in a way that made white folks feel comfortable, that made them feel safe, that made them feel less culpable for the privilege that they share. This is not the time for that. There is never a time for that. Change only comes from uncomfortable conversations. Change only comes when you are demanding and you are standing in your power and you are demanding to be treated with equality. No one gives you anything ever. Power doesn't cede to anything but power. And so if you do, and truth. So if I whitewash the truth, if I water down the truth in a way that feels more palatable to the person who is oppressing me, then I am being complicit in my own oppression. It is necessary to have these rough conversations.
You were having those rough conversations. You took it to the max every moment. But there also was some advice that you took in school, in high school, advice that you say has stuck with you, advice that you
got. That's right. Another wonderful teacher, Mr. Guadalabene, I had for sociology. And And we were having a debate in his class about abortion. And I was just viciously going after this girl who had really was only no, because nobody really teaches critical thinking, right? You're in high school. Because my mother had raised us to think critically, like always, because I grew up in a house where every time you said something, you had to cite your source. Like, it wasn't enough that you believed something. You had to have something to back it up. I didn't realize how far ahead of my peers I was in having intellectual fact-based conversations. So I was having this conversation about this debate about abortion, and I'm winning, and it's clear that I'm winning, but I'm going after this girl. Like, I'm really going for her jugular. She starts crying. And Mr. G pulled me to the side, and he said to me, "Dawn, you are absolutely right. Your logic is infallible, but you do not have to go in for the kill every single time. That sometimes in the delivery you lose the moment, you lose the opportunity to expand someone else's mindset." So he basically was like, "You can do this and you can tear your peers apart because you can. But is that really what you want to do? Is that where you want to be? Is that how you want to do the work that you're trying to do, make the changes you're trying to make?" So that was something that I became very conscious of. And I understood that that having the right message isn't enough. You have to have the right message, but you also have to be able to deliver it in a way that is fair and is not abusive.
So these are the twin horses going in some ways opposite directions that you're riding into college, right? That you need to be fervent, you need to be convicted, and you don't always have to make it taste good. And on the other hand, you want to open minds. That's what you take out of high school and then go to Florida A&M, right, for college, Florida Agriculture and Mechanical. So talk about that, about the decision to go to an HBCU.
Florida A&M changed my life. It was the best decision that I ever made, with a heavy, heavy hand from my mom, who I had actually been offered a full scholarship to Marquette University, which is a classic university in Milwaukee. And my mother was absolutely adamant that I would not go to a predominantly white school because she believed two things. Number one, it was necessary for me. I deserved to be in an environment where I was not constantly fighting racism, because both of my parents had gone to the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and had faced unimaginable amounts of racism while they were trying to do a very difficult thing, which is obtain a college education. It was clear to both of them at that moment that I needed to go to an HBCU where I would not have to fight these same kind of racial battles on a daily basis, and where I could learn more about who I was as an individual and not just a smart Black girl, but where I could be in an environment where being Black was kind of neutralized. And I could just learn, understand, and stand in my own individual brilliance, independent of race or all of the other tropes that white America puts on you when you are a part of the minority and the majority.
And you did. I mean, we should point out that you made this decision with this advice from your mother, but you did get a full scholarship to Marquette, did you not?
I did. Yeah, I did. And I was, I was the best kind of Black girl. I was the Dan Freeman before he turned into a revolutionary. I did everything right on paper. I was right. I was articulate. I was attractive. I was smart. I spoke well. I did all of those things that should make for a good, respectable Black person. I was all of those things. I was fighting. I wanted to use that in a way that did not make white folks think that I was appeasing them or I was assimilating in some way to be like them. And I needed to be in an environment, and Florida A&M gave me that. Florida A&M gave me in a place where I wasn't just smart for a Black girl, but I was smart. I wasn't just, I didn't just have strong critical thinking and strong writing skills for a Black girl. I was just a strong writer, and I was just a strong speaker. And that is an invaluable experience when you live in America, because I think so many other Black Americans who have not been through an HBCU are always questioning the validity of what they bring to the table. But having gone through HBCUs, what I know for sure is that what I bring to the table is equal or better than anything that anybody else is bringing. And I know that that is true no matter what anyone says.
I wonder if you felt that because, you know, intellectually your mother could understand it, but she didn't go to an HBCU, right? And she, but she said, wait, we think this is best, you know, for all the reasons she stated. You've got a full ride to Marquette. Dude, when you got there, did you suddenly feel it? And you've been in these AP and gifted and talented programs, so you're one of the brightest kids in the school, but also you're in a minority, right, in all of those cases. When you got there, did you actually feel the difference? Was it surprising to you how different it felt to be the same student, right, the same Dawn, but now you're in this new environment?
No, it wasn't surprising to me at all, actually. It felt like coming home. It still feels like coming home. My oldest daughter is at Florida A&M right now in the fifth year of a six-year pharmacy program, where she'll come out next year with her PharmD. It is home. It felt like home. It was the only way I can describe it to people who didn't go to an HBCU is it was like Wakanda. I think that's the closest I can explain to what it felt like. But what I also found was that where so many people were like, you're going to an HBCU and it's all Black people, it's going to be all great. What I also found was the amazing diversity that exists among Black folks. And that we are, you know, people will say HBCUs are monolithic. Nothing could be further from the truth. I experienced so many different cultures, learned so many different things just within the Black culture, from the poorest people I've ever met to folks who own property on Martha's Vineyard. That is the people, those are the people that I interacted with at Florida A&M. And it was absolutely amazing and empowering. And I also met the most amazing man I would ever meet in my entire life, my husband there, actually the same day my mom left. So that was the best decision I ever made.
Was that part of your mom's plan too?
Absolutely. my mother believed 100% that it is difficult to be a Black person in America, period. It is even harder to do it when you do not have a partner who understands what it means to be a Black person in America and understands the constant and daily pressures, stress, strain, and trauma that come with that. But she also was a very practical woman who believed that it was also important for me to find someone who was equally yoked intellectually, with the same political ideologies and things like that. So in her calculus, my mother was got her degree in chemistry and then minored in and also got a degree in childhood psychology so she could raise us. In her infinite wisdom, what she believed was that on an HBCU campus, I would be amongst the most and the highest concentration of acceptable for marriage Black men that I would ever be in my life. And so it was important for me to find one.
Once again, your mother was right.
So yes, she was.
You get your undergraduate degree. You stuck around FAMU and got your master's degree. And then while planning a wedding, getting married, and then getting pregnant, how did you balance all that? Your postgraduate degree, pregnancy, marriage, all that?
It wasn't really hard because I didn't know anything different. I had watched my mother balance amazing things. I had watched my mother growing up cultivate intentionally and deliberately a life for my brother and I while being a chemist and then changing careers and becoming an educator and also, you know, coming to speak at my school and being involved in the PTA and painting murals for Christmas on our windows. I didn't know any different. I knew that you worked and you kept moving and that is what we did. So it really didn't feel burdensome to me. It didn't even feel hard to me. It was just these are things that you do in order to get to the place that we want to get. My husband and I want to get. These are things that we have to do. And then you just do what you have to do to make it happen.
What was your vision?
It was never really a thought.
Where were you expecting to go? What did you think you were going to be doing at that moment?
So I knew, I always knew, my husband always knew that I wanted to do exactly what I'm doing right now. I wanted to go to law school. I wanted to be a lawyer that fought the man in some way, use my education and use my expertise in order to infiltrate and dismantle and fight against, rage against an oppressive system. My husband, Martin, was a nursing major when we were at FAMU. When I met him, he told me he wanted to be a nurse anesthetist, which I had no idea. I never even heard of it. And then he told me how much money he would make. And I was like, oh, yeah, I think I'm going to keep you. I'm just teasing. He was like, he's literally the love of my life. But we decided very early on that our plan was we would both finish undergraduate school. I would get a graduate degree. He would go get his graduate degree. Then I would go to law school. And then he would support our family in the lifestyle that we had grown accustomed to. And I would use my college education not to make money, but to change the world and make it better for our girls.
You have decided to wake the rest of us up, and your husband's putting us all to sleep. That's the perfect marriage. Dawn Blagrow, I'm talking to her today, Executive Director of Emancipate NC, spending the hour to learn about her upbringing and how that influenced her career today. And we'll hear more in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with Dawn Blagrow today. Her upbringing in Black nationalist household helped her to become a criminal justice reformer. Today, she's executive director of Emancipate NC, a nonprofit organization working to eliminate systemic racism and mass incarceration. So what brought you to North Carolina?
What brought us to North Carolina? Well, I wanted to go to an HBCU for law school. And my husband, we were living in Albany, New York. My husband got his master's degree at Albany Med in Albany, New York. So we were there. He was finishing up school. He had family here. We had come to visit, and we liked the area a lot. And there was an HBCU here that I could attend law school at, which was Central, North Carolina Central University School of Law. So, and the cost of living was good. So we came here. We bought a house and had another baby, and then I started studying for the LSAT. So she was about, my youngest girl was one. My oldest was five when I started law school.
Well, tell us about Madison and Erin, your two girls.
Oh, see, Frank, we only got 17 minutes. Yeah, I can talk about my baby forever and ever. Madison, I already mentioned, is my oldest. She's 21, just one of the smartest people. Second to my mother, she's probably one of the smartest people I've ever met in my life. And literally came out of the womb that way. I learned a funny story we don't have time for, but I know what a marsupial is because my two-year-old taught me. And Erin is just as brilliant, but in very different ways. She is a social butterfly. She is one of those kind of people that has a light that just attracts other folks in a way that is it's scary if you've never seen it before. She has this sense of, she actually is, Erin is for real though, my real and true Dan Freeman. She is very much a Southern girl. She wears her Tory Burch sandals and carries her Kate Spade bag, but then goes to school and gives her teachers pure hell if they are not being truthful and accurate about the state of Black people and the plight of Black people in America, if they are being inaccurate about our history or any history, if they are whitewashing it in any way. Erin is going to hold you to task at every possible turn. Just a couple weeks ago, she and I were at a protest where there was a counter protest going on outside. White folks were standing outside with signs screaming that Black Lives Matter was racist. And she said to me, "Mommy, I want to ask them a question." And I said, "Erin, really? That's what we're doing right now?" And she was like, "Yes." So I pull over and she yells out of the window with her sweet Southern voice and asks him, "Sir, can I ask you a question? Why is Black Lives Matter? Why is Black Lives Matter racist?" And from that question, Erin had a 30-minute back-and-forth conversation with a person who was visibly hostile towards who she was and what she represented, but she stood her ground, and she is her mother and her grandmother's child. So she's well educated and was able to, you know, to give it to this guy as good as he thought he was giving it, or better. I don't think I've ever been prouder of one of my children in my entire life than I was in that moment. So those are my girls.
But those are those lessons that you took out of high school, right? And they're difficult because they're so paradoxical, right? They're smashing each other in the head. The one says, get along a little bit, you know, try to find out, get yourself into the heart of that other person. The other one says, when they're wrong, you need to tell them they're wrong. And
exactly.
To be able to do both of those and say, look, I know he's wrong and I'm not walking away from this, but I think I'm going to try to enter through the heart and not the head initially.
And it is, I am like my girls, Erin especially, is at a place that it took me years to get to at 17. She is so far ahead of the game than I was when it comes to race, when it comes to the intersectionality of race and socioeconomic status and privilege in America. She's just absolutely, she's just brilliant. Well, and it is a pleasure and a joy to watch her. You know, whenever I think I'm not doing it right, we have teenage girls. A lot of times you think maybe you're missing the mark because, wow. But then every once in a while, a lot of times my girls, they remind me that I'm not missing the mark and that I'm so proud to be their mother, and the work that I'm doing is so important.
I had a teenage girl and I was never wronger in my entire life. Never wronger. Some of it I'm still paying for. So I know what you're talking about. Let's talk about you now. Back to you. You're back to law school. You're out of law school. Your first job at Prisoner Legal Services. Talk about what that was like for you.
It was a dream job for me, but it was also, well, I shouldn't say it was a dream job. It was a dream job in the sense that I was able to every single day fight against the system. It was important work, but it was the kind of work that helped me understand how our criminal justice system cannot be reformed. It has got to be destroyed, demolished, and something new has to be created in its place. Because even when I was winning, I still felt like I was losing. And the last case that I did was for a young man who I was able to get, a young black man who I was able to get about 8 to 10 years taken off his sentence. I can't remember. It was a win for us in that moment, but he still had somewhere in the neighborhood of 25 years left on a sentence. He was 25 years old. He was going to be in prison for the vast majority of his life, and we had won. And after we finished in front of the judge, I started explaining to him kind of what had just happened, and I just couldn't stop crying. And this child, this boy who is smart and it's articulate and it's kind, and had he been given different opportunities in a different set of circumstances in a different life, could have been my son-in-law, was consoling me and telling me how good of a job I had done to help him. And I got in the car and I was driving back from Charlotte I was practiced all over the state for Prisoners Legal Services. And I started driving home and I called Martin and I said, I can't do this anymore. Like, I'm going to cry right now to about it. I said, I can't do this anymore. And he said, without missing a beat, quit, find something else. So I stayed at Prisoner Legal Services for 8 years, but that being that deeply entrenched in such a corrupt system does something to your soul. And what I knew was that I needed to take a break. I needed to walk away, not from the fight, but I needed to refill my spirit, refill my soul.
Did you know that at the time? Because it can be difficult to walk away from a fight like that and realize that this is not doing anybody any good. Well, were you telling yourself that you were going to replenish and restart?
Yeah, I was. I was. And it was also at a kind of a perfect storm in my life. I, first of all, knew I had stayed at PLS 2 years longer than probably I should have. But it was only because Prisoners Legal Services was the only organization that represented incarcerated people in North Carolina on post-conviction appellate issues. And for the vast majority of the time I was there, I was the only Black attorney that was on staff. That is, in and of itself, a huge burden. And But I also understood the importance of having my voice in the room, because even those very well-meaning white lawyers who had no real experience or did not understand culturally or interpersonally the things that motivated their clients and had no real interest in figuring it out or didn't think that it was a priority to figure it out. I knew how important it was for me to be in the room to humanize our clients as we talked about them. But I also, my grandfather had died. I was in an incredibly, who was one of the most important people in my life. And I was in a very, very deep depression. I didn't know it at the time, but I figured it out a little bit later. And it was time for me to be done. But I also knew that I needed to fight the fight in a bigger way.
So how did you end up at Emancipate NC?
Funny. It's kind of that kind of divine intervention where I had gone back to Prisoners Legal Services. My boss at the time was Mary Pollard, who has just recently become the head of Indigent Defense Services over the state of North Carolina. But at the time, she was the executive director for Prisoners Legal Services. I went in to visit to say hello. And she said, "Dawn, I was just thinking about you. A job came across my desk and someone asked me for a recommendation and I'm going to give it to them. But as soon as I read this, I knew that this was where you needed to be." So I wasn't even looking for work to go back to full time work at that point. I was substitute teaching and spending my days with people's children. That felt amazing and good to my soul. But I applied for the position. It was actually closed. The position had actually closed, and Mary made a phone call to ensure that I would get an interview. And then I interviewed, and then I got the job, and I came on as the associate director of what was then Carolina Justice Policy Center, but is now Emancipate NC.
A big part of the work you do is community education. Tell us how that works.
So it really is just that, just going into the community and educating folks. What I realized from my work inside of the criminal justice system when I was working as an attorney with Prisoners Legal Services was that most people have no idea the powers and roles that and who are the most important players in the criminal justice system. That was the first thing I understood almost that I didn't realize, but I understood was a huge obstacle. The second thing was that not only did people not know who those folks were, they didn't know what they did and they didn't know the power that they had. One of the tools of oppression, one of the tools of the oppressive system, the oppressive carceral system, is to obfuscate where the power lies from the people. So what I realized was that it was necessary for me to go into the community or people like me to go into the community and tell folks what district attorneys did, what judges do, what sheriffs do, that you have the power to vote for these people and what power these three entities have for completely changing the way the criminal justice system looks and the equity in the criminal justice system within your community.
Do you think, let me interrupt you there, because it sounds like, and I wanted to maybe reconcile these things, because earlier you said at some point you realized this system can't be reformed. It has to be dismantled and rebuilt. Does that happen through this electoral process that you just described?
Yes, it absolutely did. It absolutely did. I believe very, very firmly that for a very long time that we could fix it. That it could be fixed, that if we just tweaked or just got the right people in positions of power, that we could fix it. But what I came to learn, not very long ago, I came to the realization that, again, the problem is not the people, the problem is the system itself. And that is the essence of institutional racism, is that no matter who the people are individually inside of the system, because the system is racist, because the institution is fundamentally racist, it cannot be changed. And a perfect example of that is to look at what happened, the outcome of the Breonna Taylor case, and the grand jury indictment that we saw. What happened there was absolutely legally sound, but that doesn't matter when the systems that are creating the laws are so implicitly racist and biased, that they so devalue Black lives, that the system itself is designed to minimize the value of Black lives, the value of Black women, the value of poor people, until we uproot those basic ideologies and that framework, we can't ever get to anything else.
Well, I'm going to ask you again, how does electing a district attorney or a judge change that? They're going to be working with the same fundamental system, whatever color they are and whatever school they went to.
Yes. And that's how, that's, and Frank, that's why we got to tear it down.
All right.
But I want to be clear, until we get to the place where we are rebuilding, because rebuilding takes time, we have to elect people who are progressive in these roles. I would look to Tatana DeBerry in Durham and to highlight the importance of having a district attorney who understands what equity looks like, who understands implicitly the biases that live in the system, and who goes into work every single day consciously and deliberately working against that institutional racism that exists within the system. And while it is not a cure-all, it is certainly better than having a district attorney, say, like Jim O'Neill, who is in Cumberland County, or no, I don't think he's Cumberland, but having Jim O'Neill, maybe that's Forsyth County, who doesn't care at all, is completely blind, or having a president who says that there is no institutional racism and that it is un-American to do racial equity training inside of federal entities. Like, yeah, it matters who's in those offices as we work towards abolition, as we work towards creating and reimagining a new reality and a new carceral system, or dismantling carceral systems altogether. It matters who we have in those offices, because the people who hold those that power have a tremendous amount of impact on what the system looks like every single day.
Dawn Blagrove, Executive Director of Emancipate NC. You can find links to her work at our website, stateofthings.org. Dawn, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Frank.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things. For this month's Movies on the Radio, we're going to feature your favorite movies about isolation. Send your favorite film about folks stranded on desert islands. Maybe it's psychological isolation or people drifting through outer space alone in the woods. Isolation Movies on the Radio. Email us at sot@wnc.org or tweet at us at #SOTMovie. The State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Amanda Magnus, Grant Holub-Mormon, Kaya Findlay, and Stacia Brown. Elikum Dodor is our intern, Jenny Lawson our technical director, Al Wadarski also helped engineer the show today. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.